So we've been carrying out a series of standalone talks, ambitiously called Bante's Classics. Bante, for the uninitiated, is an affectionate name. It means teacher. And our teacher, at least in the order, actually in my case I'm the disciple of a disciple of Bante, Sangharakshita. So our teacher is Sangharakshita, a man who's responsible for an enormous number of lectures and talks since the beginning of the what has become the Tri Ratna Buddhist order and community. Since the mid-60s, and we felt it was a great opportunity for us to choose our favourite of his lectures and just introduce a little bit more about it. For those of you who have been here over the last many weeks, you may have heard a little bit about tonight's seminar. The lecture itself is called A Taste of Freedom. And for those of you who have been here through our Entering the Stream seminar, part of this lecture covers the three fetters, the three things that on the breaking of which one enters the stream, the point of irreversibility, the point at which one becomes in the pull of enlightenment, as opposed to generating escape velocity from samsara, where at this point when we break these three fetters, the fetter of self-view, the fetter of doubt, and the fetter of reliance on rites and observances as ends in themselves. The breaking of those three fetters means that we are in the stream towards enlightenment. But that's just one of the things. That's one of the aspects of this lecture, A Taste of Freedom. In a way, Bante's lectures are very, very dense. They're very, very rich. And the particular part of this lecture that I wanted to focus on was, firstly, the title, A Taste of Freedom, but also the a small phrase that is the subject for the title, which comes from an early Buddhist work in the Pali Canon called the Udana. Udana means inspired utterance, or verse of uplift. And the Buddha would often just be inspired and something would spontaneously come out in the form of a poetic verse or a metaphor or a simile. And the particular simile that's used in the Taste of Freedom lecture is the ocean. And the simile goes, I'll paraphrase, I apologise if I've not got it completely correct. Just as the ocean has one taste, the taste of salt, so the Dharma has one taste, the taste of freedom. And the lecture is really an unpacking of that one simile. And I've been inspired by the notion of freedom for quite a lot of my life. As a teenager, I was involved in politics and I'm particularly concerned with rights, more than duties, I might add, at some points. This notion of rights as an avenue to freedom, that somehow the world was wrong that only if we change the world, we would all be more free. We'd all have, the world would be a better place for all. And to a certain extent, from a certain perspective, there is a truth in that. There is a truth in that. And most of us associate freedom with political freedoms, freedom of expression, freedom of thought, freedom to do what we like, freedom to love who we will. I'm sure we can all think of the notion of freedom that speaks most loudly to us. But I was also struck more recently by the story of Pandan Gelsen. I don't know if anybody has heard of him. He's a Tibetan monk who was imprisoned by the Chinese for 30 years and systematically tortured. He lost his teeth. He has a hole in the roof of his mouth. He's lost parts of limbs. And when asked, was he frightened at any point? And his response just really struck me. It gave me goosebumps. He said, the thing I was most frightened of was losing my compassion. And that spoke to me of a freedom of an altogether different order that isn't reliant on politics. It's not reliant on the conditions that we find ourselves in. It's not even reliant on physical freedom, but it is reliant on a very remarkably developed mind. That spoke to me of a more authentic freedom. And in this lecture, that's the type of freedom that Bhante is pointing to. So, after our tea break, we'll come back and explore, what the lecture says about freedom, but also how we can approach it. So let's have some tea. Okay, welcome back. So the lecture, The Taste of Freedom, starts with this phrase, just as the ocean has one taste, the taste of salt. So the Dharma has one taste, the taste of freedom. And Bhante spends a little bit more time just looking at that particular section of the Udana, the Pali text, one of the original Buddhist teachings, and the text that phrase comes from. And particularly notable about that text is the notion of the Dharma being strange and wonderful. It's strange in as much as we're not familiar with it. We don't know it. We might know some of the teachings. We might just know that there was a Buddha. But in the spirit of what's pointed to as strange in this particular context is that all of the teachings, all of everything that's written down about Buddhism is really just pointing towards something else. It's the finger pointing at the moon. The Dharma itself is strange in for its being ungraspable, unknown, in a sense to be experienced rather than to be known, and to be tasted, really, to be tasted rather than to be understood. So what most of the Buddha's teachings try to convey is a way of seeing, or a way of seeing through even, the limitations, the views that we put in the way of the clearest sight of the truth, in a sense. So, I'm not going to spend very much time on this, because the main body of the lecture is about freedom. But I do want to just say a little bit about why it's wonderful. Because if any of us have had a taste of the Dharma, one can really see how at any point in one's day, at any point in one's life, no matter what one is going through, one can come into contact with the Dharma. One can see the process of conditioned arising at work. And the more and more we see that, the more deeply we see that, the notion that everything arises in dependence on conditions, those conditions not being present, things do not arise, and things only endure as long as conditions persist or support them. The more and more we see that, the more broadly in our lives, the more and more wonderful it becomes, the more and more remarkable, you could say. And so the start of the lecture really just points out those two things. I'll stop in a minute, but I'll just say a little bit more, because that might have raised some questions already. So just to say a little bit about the notion of freedom, as meant in the lecture as well. The word for freedom is vimutti. And its translation is not only freedom, but release and emancipation. Release and emancipation. Freedom. I started writing the putting down of the burden, and then crossed out, because that doesn't mean that at all. But actually, that's the experience, as it were. That's the experience. It's almost as if you don't know the burden you've been carrying until you put it down. The burden of the self, the burden of one's views, habits, and all other things that limit, obstruct, and constrain, in a sense, us. And what vimutti means is the seeing through of all of that, the putting down of all of that, emancipation from habit, emancipation from views, a release, you could say, from bondage of our views and our limitations. And where it sits, recently we did a piece of work, as it was a piece of work, wasn't it? It was over many weeks, on the cycle and the spiral. It felt like it just went on and on. And it did, didn't it? It did for me. And it wasn't any less enjoyable. The Dharma is enjoyable. And at the very last week, we did a session on the upper echelons of the spiral path. And I apologise for those of you who weren't here, but just to place vimutti in its in context, vimutti is the stage it's the penultimate stage before enlightenment. The only stage after vimutti, after emancipation, is realizing that you're emancipated. Yeah? That's the last stage. There's one of being emancipated, or being freed, or achieving enlightenment, or arriving in nirvana. Not a place, more I don't know if you'd say state of mind. But then there's the final piece of the spiral path, which is realizing that you've been emancipated, recognizing that you're enlightened. So it occupies a very, very remarkable place. Okay, so it led me to wonder whether we can get any kind of sense of freedom anywhere else in the spiritual life. Can there be a foreshadowing of freedom in the sense of a muti, in a sense of emancipation, at any other point? Obviously, one might not be completely emancipated, but is there any sense in which we can get a taste of that? In a way, it seems reasonable that there should be a taste of that at any point when we're making progress on the spiral path, or in the spiritual life at all. Any time we go beyond a habit, or we get released from an unhelpful habit, surely maybe that has a flavour. So I thought the most helpful way to structure any discussion about freedom, and particularly ground it in somewhere where most of us are, because most of us, and you can tell me afterwards if you like, if you're not still working at the coalface of habit and everyday life, because I am. And I think most of the time what we want is something practical that we can perhaps go away with and start thinking about how we can introduce more freedom into our lives, how we can get more of a taste of that, more of a sense of that. So there are five great stages of the spiritual path, and I thought we might structure our discussion around them. And the first stage being integration. But before we move on to that, and which is the main body of the night, I thought we'd just pause there to see if there are any responses or questions for clarification from the preamble.
Sorry, can you just clarify? I know it's a very big area, but the aspect about conditions, things depend on conditions.
So you could say that all things are impermanent. You could say that things are not only impermanent, but insubstantial. Not only are things always changing, but all things are change. To ground that is, my favourite example of that is the body. And I've said this, I think, three times at this class, so I apologise if I'm just recycling old material. But there isn't one cell in the body that existed on the day we were born, okay? And the body is continuously in a cycle of growth and renewal and decay, yes? But in order for that growth and renewal to take place, we need sustenance, we need air, and we need warmth, and these are conditions. These are conditions. And so a condition for warmth would be the sun. You take the sun away and there's not much life anywhere, at least not here. But not only that, we need clothing. And then there's whoever produced the clothing. And then there was what the clothing was made out of. These are all conditions. Yes? You don't have to go very far before you start seeing that the number of conditions that go to make up a single moment of our lives is uncountable. You can just keep on going into this immense constellation of conditions that go to make up a single moment for us. And it isn't something that's fixed in time. It includes every moment. So do you get more of a sense of what we mean by conditions? Does that make sense? So it's a continuous flow of a continuous process of arising and ceasing of conditions. And conditions came into creating our being. The conditions for most of us at the moment are sustaining our being. And then when the conditions for our being cease, we will cease. So we will die. And then the energy that's liberated keeps on going. And well, Buddhism says that goes into a new life. But we've done that quite a lot, and I don't want to spend too much time on rebirth, if that's okay. So, but to give you a sense of the conditions. Anything else? Does that answer your question? Yeah? Okay. So let's come on to integration. So integration is a stage of the path where we start, really. I'm wondering if anybody can say, who's been around a while, or maybe give who hasn't been around a while, what we mean by integration.
I suppose what I know it to mean is trying to bring together and enfold disparate parts of the self, you know, everything there is, really, and try to enfold it in. Rather than reject bits and split things off, it's trying to sort of bring as much of the self on board with forward movement of some sort.
Absolutely. Did you all get that? So it's a sense of that we're, it's almost as if sometimes that we are multiple different people, depending on the particular company and conditions that we find ourselves in. It's almost like the common example, which you've probably all heard, is, you know, we make an intention to meditate, going to bed at night, and then we wake up, it's almost like somebody else woke up with no intention to meditate. That's something probably we can all relate to. Yeah? But it's almost like a different person woke up. And I think there's something quite important about integration in that one of the distinctive features of integration is that we have a continuity of purpose. From bringing our disparate selves together through awareness, through mindfulness, we become more aware of the limiting habits and views and that we maintain, that and we through becoming more conscious of them become less under their influence, or at least have more of a choice in what we do or how we respond in particular situations. So what the practices that support this are obviously the mindfulness of breathing. The stages of the path are all supported with handy meditation practices. And the mindfulness of breathing is about developing awareness, developing not only a continuity of purpose, but as I said at the beginning of the class, recollection. We remember that we're supposed to be practicing. We remember what our purpose is. And It's almost like we're aware moment to moment. And if we're aware moment to moment of what's arising in the mind, we have more of an opportunity to intervene and to create space where we can act from or choose our response to whatever's arising in the world. So I wonder, are there any particular freedoms associated with that? I think I've just pointed to one, which is the notion of choice. The sense that we're not so much at the mercy of our habits. It's not as if stimulus or experience comes in and we react unthinkingly. But if there's mindfulness around, if there's awareness around, then there's a possibility of a choice, of a response, as opposed to a reaction. So I'm wondering whether that could be a foreshadowing of a form of freedom, of being more in control of one's own mind. Oh, if anybody's got any responses to that.
Well, I experience that every day. Every day I'm very aware of that. I'm very aware of stimulus at work. I'm very aware of my reactions to various conditions, and I think increasingly I'm aware of this idea that that there exists a space in between stimulus and my reaction to it, in which, as you say, in which I can try and make a wiser choice. It's really moving, actually. It's really moving because I can see this space increasing. I can see it getting deeper or broader if I remember to put into action the positive things that I learn. I don't always remember to do it, and often I remember after I've reacted, perhaps negatively, and that brings on further suffering in itself, because you think, why isn't that doing that? What am I doing? But even that's quite nice, because afterwards you can sort of get home and think, I got cross with myself then, but at least I know why I got cross with myself, because I'm aware that I made a bad choice, and I didn't try and explore this space where I can make wise choices. So it's possible, even in the suffering of it, to at the end of the day you sort of go, I'm still here, and it's okay, because it wasn't that bad.
It's my 13-year-old niece. Last time I was with my sister, was shuffling a little bit, and my sister, her mother, gave her a bit of nudge. Go on, ask him. And she was basically wanted to ask what Buddhism was, and but she didn't know how to ask the question. I had no idea how to answer the question to a 13-year-old girl, and. But one of the things I thought it was exactly that, which was, have you ever said something you wish you hadn't? Mm-hmm. Have you ever had the experience of it being out there, and then you have to deal with all of the consequences? Well, Buddhism's sort of about making less and less of those events happen. From a certain perspective, at least when you're starting, there's something about being a bit more able to say what you mean and mean what you say. If we can be more alive to what's going on in our minds. But she seemed to get that. I think I chose that. She has lots of propensity for saying things. She's delightful. She's delightful, but she's very, very gobby. and I love her dearly. But yeah, so we can all find our own perhaps relationship to how integration might bring about a foreshadowing of a bit more freedom. I was wondering whether, you know, if we practice mindfulness, we develop a sort of psychological strength, a sort of fortitude of mind, an ability to be with what we're doing, an ability to concentrate and to choose where our attention goes. A sort of independence of mind, who's sort of less under the influence of others' views or opinions. A more self-possessed state, not one that's alienated or cool or detached, but one that's just a bit more solid and confident. Yes, and with more of ourselves acknowledged. And I think that's something that came up for me when I was thinking about it, is in a sense you could say the unconscious is that which is unacknowledged in us. And as we meditate, as we integrate, more and more of that becomes conscious, more and more of that becomes, we could say, just acknowledged. And its grip over us, for driving our behaviour, becomes weaker in a way. And I'm wondering whether we could see that as a form of, or at least a foreshadowing of, more freedom, less under the grip of the unacknowledged in us. And certainly I think these things arise out of mindfulness and out of regular meditative practice. So I wondered if there were any comments on that or any other questions.
Are you trying to say that if a group of people are about to, say, buy the same food, like Chinese food, and someone has never tried that and has never tried the other option, which could be, say, Indian food, that person may actually like Indian food without realising, but will choose the Chinese because it's a safer option because everybody else will choose it. Does that make sense?
I wonder, I think sometimes what happens when we're more integrated is that we might have more of a sense of adventure, and more of a sense of the explorer, more of a sense of wanting to discover. Because anybody who's done any work on themselves and realizes has that aha moment when we discover something about ourselves, a particular habit, and we sort of see them coming around like, old friends. Aha, there you are again. We have a sense of wonder about the mind. We have a sense of interest. And that sort of perfumes our life more broadly. So we would be equally maybe as happy to go along with our friends because it doesn't cause us concern ethically as it would be to perhaps say to our friends, we have Chinese all the time, why not try something different? So it's not necessarily a matter of not going along with people. One might take a view that that one goes along with people because it doesn't compromise my principles. In the Buddhist sense, that would be the ethical principles of the training principles of precepts of non-harm, for example. So you might choose something without meat. Do you see what I mean? So it's not necessarily about not going along with people, but one might have a keener sense of one's principles and how they inform the choices you make. Does that make sense?
Can I ask, do you think it's possible to integrate what might seem to be quite discrete aspects of your life? So for example, if you have a quite a materialistic lifestyle and you have a lot of materialistic people, and that's kind of at odds with you know, something that we might be learning here in the Dharma.
Mm.
And do you think that the inevitable outcome is that one or the other, you end up choosing between these two mutually exclusive and highly conflicting communities and lifestyles and attitudes, that, or do you think it's possible to be some maybe middle way, or to do both at the same time?
Mm. It's quite a difficult question, isn't it? And I'm disinclined to answer substantively, because I think from the point of view of materialism is obviously very influential. The whole of society, the whole of advertising, you know, we all know it's there. We're very, and it plugs into that sense of craving, that sense of, what do I need, what do I need? We're not quite sure what it is, but that will do for now, kind of experience. Yeah? And then, you know, the thing about materialism is that we are craving our sense of, what do I need? You know, it's like, it's that, you know, it's always in us as that sort of, you know, trying to, it's like the fingers going all the time. You know, just, And, you know, we keep on reaching for things, but they don't quite satisfy us. So we're looking for something. We're always looking for something. And it will become clear how materialism doesn't satisfy when we develop enough awareness of the fact that it doesn't satisfy. And until we have a real sort of alive sense of that, and the positive counterpart, which is contentment, and the things that bring about contentment, then it's going to be very difficult to sort of wrench ourselves away from a particular set of conditions that we may be quite happy in. So I think there is sometimes a mistake in trying to radically change one's life from a life based on having lots to a life based on more and more of less and less too quickly, and you can end up having all kinds of reactions and boomerang elastic band type of effects pinging out of the spiritual life, and it needs to be a gentle process, one based on the awareness of what really satisfies, what really makes a difference, what really makes one happy, and not based on the fact that of materialism. So I'm sort of approaching it from the other side, really, because I don't think that we are where we are, basically. We are where we are, and we have to work from where we are, in the conditions from where we are. And some of us don't have the option of changing radically too quickly. You know, we all have commitments, and we have to live in the world. Yeah. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question? What do you want to say to me?
One of the really baffling things for me in my life is the amount of where I have knowledge of the fact that, say, for example, wanted to download lots of Kindle books and music for iTunes, and knowing that if I do, I won't listen to them and I won't read them.
Mm.
But somehow the moment of purchase is going to give me a sort of kick.
Mm.
I know I'm not going to read it, I know I'm not going to listen to it in the way that I think, and yet I still do it. With full knowledge. And it's slightly back.
Yeah.
Just me.
Yeah. And in a certain way, that's... What do you think is missing in that?
An brain?
I think the brain's functioning well. I think the brain's functioning fine. But
the fact that it's too easy to do, so just with one pick.
I think I was doing it before the candle. I was doing it in bookshops before the. I think it's the impulse, the thought that that might complete, the complete experience of life that I'm looking for. And that's too tempting. And that's.
Yeah. Maybe it's the difference between the knowledge and the realization, because it's all very well knowing something. I can, you know you shouldn't do something, or knowing that, you know, that really this isn't, you're going to come away from this feeling like eating too much cake and feeling sick. But the difference between realization that you shouldn't do it and that you don't need it or you don't want it really.
Well, there's a difference between knowing and realization, isn't there? And I wonder whether it's the level of integration behind the act. Behind the act of, dare I say it, renunciation. Because it's more of the nature of we integrate deeper and deeper emotionally. And more of our emotions are behind our values. In a sense, you could say what we value is in our emotions. It's an emotional dimension of our being, and if our emotions aren't engaged behind our act, then we're always going to be divided a little bit. Because actually, as soon as we start to try and let go a little bit, let go of those habits, there's always going to be a reaction, because we've always been able to. We've got those habits very firmly developed. There's a very senior member of the order living in one of the women's ordination training centres, and her advice is, work on your samskaras now, because when you get to my age, it's almost impossible. So the samskara, the volitions, the things that the deep habits that we have become deeper, become stronger. People say as you get older, you get more fixed in your ways, and to a certain extent, if we're not acting in any way counter to that, that's what will happen. What we do, we become. So, in that sense, sometimes sitting down and having a word with ourselves before the point of by now is what we have to do. We have to intervene quite strongly and just say, actually, I know I'm not going to read this. No. And then know that the reaction won't kill us. But at the same time, or maybe I'll leave it there, sometimes we have to intervene quite strongly. Sometimes we have to manage the hindrance, consider the consequences of, am I just wasting money here? Could I be putting this money to a better use? Have I got disposable income that I'm spending here? Or am I getting myself deeper into debt because I'm feeling quite miserable in the first place? Or whatever particular conditions, we can't speak specifically without knowing individual conditions. But it's worthwhile asking ourselves some questions about our buying behaviours. And I'm not saying don't buy things. But actually, what I might be pointing to is what we think will give us pleasure, that only gives us pleasure for a moment. We might want to refine that sense of what gives us pleasure into something that endures more firmly.
I've been dying to ask.
Sorry, yeah.
What about I crave learning.
Mm.
How about that?
And what's the question?
And what about when you want the cake and or the book, and it's a craving, and it just hits the spot, it's perfect. And it's like, it's an unbalanced craving. It's like, I really want to eat that piece of chocolate cake. And you eat it, and it's perfect. You really want to buy first edition of Moby Dick, you've always wanted it, and you read it, you get enormous pleasure from it, and you can, and you knew you wanted it, and you got it. Yeah. Perfect.
But it is a remarkable book, isn't it?
You know what I mean? What about when you crave something and you're right?
Yeah. Well, I think actually, I said this before as well, I think craving's got a bit of a bad rap in Buddhism. I might be being heretical here. But actually, it's more about refining the sources of craving or the experiences of craving too. Yes? So what we're trying to do is gradually slow down the wheel. Okay. So if we can't intervene before we've pressed buy, okay, then perhaps we can set up some systems and some questions to ask ourselves before we press buy next time. Or we can think about, I don't think there's probably much harm in reading Moby Dick, but, you know, it's a remarkable novel. If that then means we read novels endlessly and don't meditate, then it might be that we want to it's a giggles of recognition, but maybe we want to just sort of eke out 20 minutes in our 12 hours novel reading for meditation. Do you see what I mean? You know, we might want to organize our lives a bit differently. But I think to say more on the craving issue is we sometimes crave quite gross things. For example, you know, food, sex and sleep. Okay, chocolate cake's in there. I made a vow to myself, actually, I wasn't going to use the example of the chocolate cake anymore, because we do it quite well here. But okay. But we might want to move those types of coarse craving into more refined craving. So we might move from looking at our obsessions with sex, if we have them, and thinking, okay, what am I getting out of that? What am I actually really looking for? Is it possible to say a lot of sex is looking for intimacy? And actually, do we need to do more work on our friendships? So the urge for fulfillment through intimacy is met in a different way. It's one way of expressing, particularly if we have a more neurotic habit towards sex. I'm just using that as a very coarse example. But what are the views, what are the opinions, the things we've taken for granted that underpin those coarser actions? And do we understand them clearly? And then if we do have a greater understanding of them, can we refine them? There's examples in the Buddhist texts of people desiring to see the Buddha, craving to see the Buddha. And they're not considered unskillful, and not considered unskillful, because when the craving is met, the craving ceases, okay, because it's deeply satisfying. So in a certain sense, being satisfied is not a bad state to be in. Do you see what I mean? Does that make sense? Does it make sense of sort of trying to move from coarser forms of craving into slightly more refined sources of craving? It's not that craving in itself is bad or wrong. It's more a case of that we need to move from coarser forms to more refined forms. And then we actually may move into a state of greater contentment where craving naturally dissipates. You were saying something over there.
I don't want to contradict what you just said, but part of the craving, isn't it? Craving for a reward, kind of a symbolic, things like chocolate cake, or books and DVDs, or sex. Isn't there possibly part of you that feels like whatever I've behaved well, I've been working hard, therefore I deserve a reward, and that's kind of a source of craving, and it becomes secondary whether the reward actually nourishes you, whether you even enjoy it. You know, even if you hate chocolate cake, you'd have chocolate cake instead of whatever, a high energy drink, because a high energy drink's just not a treat. So how do you deal with the craving for, for some kind of reward or recognition that you've been a good person?
Is there a difficulty with that?
You could make yourself aware if you knew that once you've done it, you would be feeling positive about it rather than negative. Where, like the Kindle example, if you know you're going to ignore it once you've bought it, you could introduce a consequence such as delete it as soon as you bought it, because you know you won't read it. So then you wouldn't want to buy it. But if you really like the cake, and you will enjoy the cake, then you're going to have the cake.
But there's kind of, you might feel the need to have a substitute for the reward that you're denying yourself, right? Isn't there some metaphor about removing a dowel from a mitre vendor? Is it something you have to knock, the way they take a dowel out of the hole is to knock another dowel in its place. And if you don't do that, you can't get it. You see, you crave, just removing the reward, probably in the long term is unlikely to work, because you're just going to be like, I'm never rewarded.
I think I wonder whether it's our sense of what gives us pleasure changes over time. Through developing awareness, the things that we were more intoxicated with become less appealing as we see their limitations more and more. And we look for deeper senses of pleasure, more refined or more authentically satisfying forms of pleasure. But that only arises in dependence on awareness. And it only arises in dependence on emotional positivity, which is the next stage of the spiritual path, which I think we should move on to, making a link. So it is important that, to come back to the notion of freedom, that I wonder whether the foreshadowing of freedom comes as in reflection of greater integration, less being at the mercy of our habits and our limitations. So freedom arising from emotional positivity. We're of course talking about metta, loving kindness, emotional positivity, is the meditation practice that supports this. But I wonder whether as a result of greater emotional positivity, we develop greater purpose, more of a balanced perspective, less pendulum swings in our experience, emotional pendulum swings. In a sense, we become more able to be with the breadth of our experience as a result of the integration and awareness with the highs and lows of our emotions. But because of emotional positivity, they don't shake us up so much. It's almost like we're bigger to hold them. Yes? We're bigger to hold the heights and depths and breadths of our emotional world. And in that way, we're perhaps looking for less external validation. We don't need so much. We perhaps feel more replete. We don't need validation from external sources, or at least our well-being and our psychological welfare doesn't rely on it so much. Our sense of esteem becomes more independent. There's something that, looking at it from another angle, in terms of positive emotion. Something Subhadramati said when we were talking about ordination, is just imagine a life that was dominated by the principle of generosity. Imagine a life that was dominated by the principle of loving kindness. And are there any responses to that?
But it's worn out.
Yeah. Isn't it immediately appealing? I mean, the implications are a bit more difficult, but the principle's very appealing. And if we have experience of being generous and just being able to give in a sort of very unfettered manner, what's the experience of that like?
But I think what's really interesting is I think for a lot of people it feels so intuitive, and yet it's actually on a practical level how we manifest that is so limited.
So it's almost like the gap between the person we want to be and where we are. And we're actually in the spiritual life, we're working in that gap all the time. We know, in a sense, that's looking at our potential, in a sense, isn't it? We know we all possess that potential.
For me, that kind of brings to mind that I would have to let go of all my negative emotions, and then I realise I cling to them. Negative states. If I could just sort of be flooded with love, as it were.
But people are nasty. There's lots of horrible people out there, so you've just got to, got to be careful. You don't want to be too nice, because sometimes there can be really nasty bacteria and then you feel like a rag mug.
They say about the hurt that hang on to them, maybe it's kind of related a bit, because in some ways our kind of negative emotions to kind of keep us safe, because it's kind of keeping us out in a way, and it kind of, it keeps us safe.
And we could say people are just trying to get their needs met, couldn't we? And they might go about that in very strange ways that seem almost harmful. And I think the but to stay with the emotional positive from it, but I think that we have to acknowledge that there are. In acting to get needs met, people behave in quite abominable ways sometimes. But if we focus on freedom that arises from emotional positivity, are there any others? Any other aspects to that?
Well, I was going to say actually related to that, that maybe with the positive emotions that it kind of gives you the strength to let go of the negativity, so it gives you a kind of strength that maybe you're not as scared about being vulnerable and opening yourself up to being able to love people and let them love you.
I think it is an effect of it, actually. It is an effect that you enter into a more open way of being. That isn't so fearful of being seen. A lot of the time we fear being really seen because we have an idea that we'd somehow be vulnerable. And the being awash in emotional positivity shows that for the illusory view that it is. We, in the order, I was just speaking before the break about the how in the order we try, at least to our friends and our chapters, the order members we meet with regularly, try and be more and more open, more and more honest. And there's a practice of confession that we use to do that and looking at transgressions of the precepts. And in my experience of that is actually it's liberating. It's it is a weight off the mind. You know, we carry unskillful acts as weights, sort of psychological weights, which we don't realise. And they do, they keep us awake at night, or they do, make the gut tease a little bit, don't they? When we're not acting from the best in ourselves, and we're not acting skillfully, ethically. So, however, being more and more open, we find that we're less, being more and more transparent, we're able more freely to commit, more freely to love. Particularly with our friends, because there's nothing to hide, there's nothing to fear. I don't know if you feel that too when you you find that happens.
Mm. Yeah, I think I like your idea of, well, you're talking a bit about burden.
Yeah.
Letting go of the burden.
Yeah.
There's something about just having a clear conscience as well, I think. You don't have to sort of hold on to a sort of putting a view, having a self view to, putting up a face, as it were, to the world. You just let that drop a bit. And then that sort of, you don't have to expend that energy in sort of trying to be someone.
So I just want to move on a little bit because we're running perilously out of time. It's a very interesting area of exploration. But I just want to move on to I think the to the sort of final one for tonight, which is spiritual receptivity. On the basis of integration and impulsive emotion, as we gather more and more of ourselves behind our spiritual practice, we eventually have to ask ourselves how willing are we to really taste the teachings? How willing are we really to put things into practice, to put what we know into practice? We know, so much of a matter of integration is knowing we should do one thing, but we do something else. And the more and more integrated, the more emotionally positive we become, the more and more able we are to do what we mean and what we intend to. It's almost as if we are more our own agents, if I were to put it bluntly. And so we can move into really testing and tasting the teachings very fully, the Buddhist teachings. We can, if we are integrated, if we're emotionally positive, we can take responsibility for the degree to which we put into practice a particular teaching. And we can experiment with it, really taste it. And when it comes back to this, if we go back to that original Udana, that verse of uplift, the taste of freedom, or the ocean having the taste of salt, well, we're tasting the Dharma. At these classes, we're tasting the Dharma whenever we read a Dharmic book. But and we're sort of laying the ground, as it were, for our developing Dharmic perspective. Okay, so we're gradually informing our mind of a number of perspectives that are helpful, like the principle of conditionality that we saw, which we visited at the beginning of the class. We could say, the Dharmic perspective of just things are a process, yeah? And we can reflect on that, and we can let it in, yeah? Or we can reflect on impermanence, and just be open to what that teaches us. We can really sort of take that in, and see it at work in ourselves and the world around us. And see what effect that has. There really isn't time to go into the gateways to liberation, but for but very briefly for impermanence, insubstantiality, and unsatisfactoriness, each has a corresponding gateway of liberation. Each has a positive counterpart, if that could be a way of speaking about it. I encourage you to find out about those three. There are talks from on the website of our exploration of those three gateways to liberation. But the more and more we take in those teachings, the more and more we put them into practice, the more and more we reflect on them, the more there is the likelihood that in a moment of stillness, that a spontaneous contemplation of those principles will arise. So, for example, if we've reflected on impermanence, if we've really chewed it over, we've tasted it, we've internalized it, we know what it means, and then in meditation, we might see that directly in our body. We might actually really see very clearly that process at work in ourselves. And there may be a moment of realization, a moment of contact with reality. And and at that point, we might actually experience a real moment of liberation. We might even be seeing through that principle directly in our own experience. And at that point, we might be moving from the point of generating escape velocity from habit and limiting views and vagueness and doubt into real clarity, into creativity, into a creative way of being. Because we've understood that principle deeply, and it's reorientated us. That's the point at which real transformation starts to occur. That's the point where we really start to taste freedom, is when we start to see the reality of the process that the Buddha is pointing to. So, I think we'll leave it there for tonight. And I wish you well. Till next week.
Thank you.